This is the age of being real. Stories about people who have found their unique path in life at any age. I'm Rhonda Miller. Imagine a path in life that includes being the superhero Spider-Man. Well, Jerry Colpitz traveled that path, making personal appearances as Spider-Man for 22 years, and it took him around the world. But like anyone who's been fortunate enough to live through many decades, Colpitz has had dark times and joyful ones. Diabetes diagnosed when he was 13. Making his way as a young actor in New York. Marriage. Divorce. Then a long-term loving relationship with the woman he calls his life partner, Rita Hamilton, a dancer who was beloved by students in her Brooklyn dance studio. Alcohol. Now 9 years sober. Losing his life partner, Rita, to cancer just a few years ago. Grief. Approaching his 70th birthday, Colpitz is finding new roles and renewed joy acting for TV and independent films. I talked with him in his apartment in the Greenpoint section of Brooklyn, New York, where the refrigerator is covered by a poster of a Japanese film star and Jerry as Spider-Man. When did you first consider being an actor? Do you recall?
We moved around a lot when I was a kid, three or four places in New England. When we moved to Littleton, New Hampshire, when I was like in fifth grade, my mother, she directed us to do a song called I Wish I Was Single Again. And, you know, my sister is a year older than me. The two of us had a routine and we'd perform for family when they'd come to visit. You know, we'd do this routine.
In fifth grade?
Yeah, in fifth grade, fourth grade, yeah.
So you were singing?
Singing and dancing and doing kind of mime work. When I was single, my pockets would jingle, so I had a pocket full of change, you know, and my wife, she died, and Debbie would, you know, lie down and die, and then I married another, the devil's grandmother. We did this whole routine that was actually really funny, and so my mother saw in the paper that there was a talent contest, so my mother signed us up to do this talent contest. You know, the whole town showing up with, you know, kids playing harmonicas. And Debbie and I performed the routine that we practiced in the kitchen. And we won the talent contest. That really kind of, that having no idea what the heck was going on, but getting the applause and everything, and just feeling elevated. Just like, I don't know what just happened, but I like this. And now, you know, I haven't really thought of it this way before, so interesting talking to you because it's occurring to me now. That was a big day, perhaps sent me in the direction just loving to be on stage. When I was in seventh grade, my dad got a job as a manager of a J.J. Newberry's in a town, Farmington, Maine, in the ski areas, Sugarloaf Saddleback. That's where I luckily wound up going to high school. I was on the ski team because I grew up in New Hampshire and, you know, had my first pair of skis when I was 3 years old. So
oh, wow.
I knew what I was doing. So
wow, that's an early time. Is that when you start skiing?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And this high school had a strong theater department. You know, here I am going into eighth grade and I didn't know anybody. That was a tumultuous year in many ways.
Why was that?
Well, I developed type 1 diabetes, insulin-dependent diabetes, which I've been living with my entire life, actually. Yeah. Three injections a day.
And you had to do that as a young teenager.
As an eighth grader.
Yeah, wow. I'm just wondering if there's a moment when you said, I guess I'll go to the theater group after school.
I just had never felt so thrilled as to when I was on stage. Wearing somebody else's shoes, pretending to be somebody else, you know, forget your troubles, come on, get happy. You know, put your own life and your diabetes and your whatever, behind you and step into somebody else's world. We loved it.
Did your mother ever act? Or, like, she was really encouraging you. Did she have dreams of acting or something?
Absolutely not. No, absolutely not. She was a school teacher for years, you know, 35 years. She taught grade school, actually. Everybody loved Dottie Colpitz. She had a routine that she would do. They'd get her up on stage, and she loved the spotlight. You could tell she loved the spotlight, and she would do Little Orphan Annie Comes to Our House to Play. This was her favorite story and had done it forever and was really good at it. You know,
so she liked being on stage too. Yeah. So it wasn't just
right.
She was really.
Yeah. And she loved to have fun.
So did you do theater also in high school?
Yeah, my third year in high school, we entered the one act play contest. We did a one act play version of Spoon River anthology. People dead on a hill basically telling their stories. So coming back to life and telling their stories and all. they were just short little vignettes and monologues. I did 4 or 5 of them. It's funny when you do something like that, the lines still stick with it. I was Willie Medcalf. They used to call me Dr. Myers because they said I looked like him. And he was my father, according to Jack McGuire. I lived in the livery stable, sleeping on the floor, side by side with Roger Bauman's bulldog, or sometimes in a stall. I could crawl between the legs of the wildest horses without getting kicked. We knew each other. I can still remember, I did Willie Loman in college. I played Willie Loman, my God, at age 20.
The salesman.
Yeah, Death of a Salesman. I can still remember. Well, I was driving along one day, you know, I was fine. I was even observing the scenery. You can imagine me looking at scenery on the road every week of my life. Oh, but so beautiful up there, Linda. The air is so thick and the sun is warm. I just open the window and let the warm air bathe over me. And then all of a sudden, I'm going off the road. I tell you, I absolutely forgot I was driving. You can imagine me. But those lines still, they're still there. Yeah, that's so funny.
So you went to college where people usually try to tell you to do something reasonable so you can earn a living and support yourself.
I'm not quite sure how it worked out. I've got a sneaking suspicion. When I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, when I was, you know, between 7th and 8th grade, I heard the doctor. I happened to overhear the lovely doctor, I know his name, Dr. Condit, tell my parents, you know, there's a good chance that he's going to, by the time he's, you know, 19, 20, he's going to have difficulties. He's going to develop problems.
How old were you then?
I was 13. It was a big moment in my life when I was hearing that. And
of course, they didn't know you heard it.
No, but I had a sneaking suspicion that let him go to University of Maine and be a theater major and, you know, sure, give it a shot. But he's not going to be around that long.
You never wavered. That was it. You went to, and where'd you go to college?
University of Maine in Orono. By the time I graduated from college, I had told so many people I was going to move to New York and be an actor in New York. I'd never been there. But I decided, I guess I better.
That was it. Since the first being on stage with your sister, you never really wavered from the path.
Right? I like the way you put that, actually. But, you know, it's... it's true. Never wavered from the path. Oh, sure. You know, I mean, I was all over the place. You know, when I got to New York in 1976, I got immediately into an acting class. So here I am, you know, moving from a small town in Maine to the middle of New York City in the hot and heavy 70s, the 70s, and all kinds of stuff was going on. But I landed right in Hell's Kitchen, moved in with a guy I knew was going to NYU from Farmington, actually, Farmington, Maine. And he was studying NYU and had some space on his floor of his apartment for me to, you know, to land on. And here I am, just this eager kid in the middle of New York City and just overwhelmingly loving it. Just thrilled, you know, this is the heart of everything. And my dad had given me $1,000 before I took off. And, you know, I can still kind of see him whispering to my mother on the porch, you know, he'll be back when the money runs out, you know. As I'm wandering around the city going, oh, man, I can't even get interviewed for, like, office work. I have no skills, you know. I had no experience, no skills. I was just out of college. I studied theater, for God's sake. And I'm walking down Central Park South, which, I don't know if you know, Central Park South is a line of all these fancy hotels and everything. And I'm watching these guys loading luggage into the backs of taxi cabs and people giving them cash.
Doorman.
Tipping the doorman, you know? Aha. So a couple of days I hit every hotel up and down Central Park South, and three of them wanted to hire me.
Wow, you found your place.
And suddenly, bingo! You know, I kind of hit the jackpot, and it was a wonderful job for me. The Hotel Navarro on Central Park South. Luciano Pavarotti had a suite there.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Leonard Bernstein had a suite there. Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band stayed at the Navarro. In fact, I was midnight doorman one time, and he was coming in after a concert at the Palladium. He was just really taking over the world, you know, with his Born to Run album and all. And 3 in the morning, I'm looking after the lobby of the hotel, and he he comes in and always waiting for the damn elevator in the place. It was slow. I said, how's the show going, Bruce? He goes, are you going to see it? And I said, tickets, forget about it. He said, come on. He invited me to get on the elevator, go up to his room. A moment like this, really, I'm riding up in the elevator in the middle of the night with Bruce Springsteen. Opened his door up and goes into a sock drawer or something and pulls out two tickets, fourth row center for the concert that week.
You went to the concert?
Oh, yeah, fourth row center.
Wow.
Yeah. I was still, taking acting classes, and I was still, I was doing some off-Broadway theater, get cast in a few things. There's something so great about being in a cast with a bunch of folks who are there for the love of it, because it's just, you create a family. And you're doing plays about families, theater is really a magical place. It is. And it's, I fell in love with it when I was a kid, for God's sake. And I still love it.
Yeah. How long did it take you to get to Spider-Man?
I'd been at the hotel a couple of years. They have a weekly newspaper, casting newspaper called Backstage. And actually, in my acting class, a good friend of mine, Max, he called me up one day and he said, "You see him backstage, man? They're looking for superhero types for a fledgling personal appearance program at Marvel Comics." And I said, "Wow!" And I guess they stick you in a costume and open toy stores or something. I don't know. I'm not sure what it is, but maybe, you're in good shape. You ought to, check it out.
How was it I guess it was an audition?
Interview first. But it was incredible because it was held at Marvel Comics headquarters. Getting on the elevator, going up, okay, I got an interview with Droni Pollock, who was head of marketing. And she was interviewing actors.
So, and it wasn't an acting job in film?
No. Although I have done a number of TV shows and everything, as the character through the years. A few appearances on, like, the Today Show. Or in events, I was, I did 8 Macy Thanksgiving Day parades here in New York.
How did you get chosen, do you think? You went for an interview. That wasn't an audition.
Yeah, and they, no. And then they had me improvise talking to kids. I'd done some work with children. I worked in a summer camp for kids in Maine. So I knew about, how to communicate with kids and everything. They said, come back tomorrow and see how you look in the costume. They gave me the costume and a couple of other actors there. And they had, change in this closet here. So I went in and...
You changed in the closet?
Yeah. Skin-tight spandex. Sliding that thing on, fitting it up my leg, and wow, I like the feel of this, And I'm just putting it on, all right, fingers, wow, fingers, skin-tight, red and blue, and webbed. They get the webs, and I used to read the comic, too, so I kind of knew what I was getting into, in a way. And then the mask was hanging down. Okay, all right, and it zips across the back. Let's see if I can do this. All right, slide the head over, and it was a white mesh across my eyes, right? Can I see in this thing? I think so. All right, adjust it, and then get it zipped across the back. And I looked up in the mirror, and I saw the Amazing Spider-Man looking back at me. And I realized at that point that I could be anybody in this costume. Nobody knows who I am. Okay, Jerry, your turn. Knock on the door. I opened the door. Something really overtook me, and I dashed over to Ronnie Pollock's desk. I leaped up on the desk. I leaned forward, and I stuck out my hand, my webbed hand, and I said, "Shake hands with Spider-Man." And she just leaned back in her chair and said, "I think you're going to work out fine, Jerry. I think this is going to work. All right. Our next trip is, can you be in South Carolina, next week?" I'd never traveled anywhere before in my life, and suddenly I was really on the road carrying a Spider-Man costume.
Did you? You didn't plan it, though. You didn't plan it.
No, just...
Was that you or was that Spider-Man?
It was Spider-Man, yeah. No, I'm not a terribly outgoing person.
So what was that job called? I mean, because it wasn't really for theater. It was for...
It was personal appearance programs. The opening of state fairs. And anyway, eventually I earned the right to be almost all of the corporate appearances for Marvel Comics. The creator, Stan Lee, the legendary Stan Lee. He used to love to have me with him. We traveled to Japan together. We traveled all over the world together at big conventions. And he liked having Spider-Man with him because it drew attention to him. Wherever Spider-Man goes, he's the center of attention. They flew me up to Alaska, and I did an Eskimo village in Alaska.
How many years were you Spider-Man?
It stopped just after 9/11, 20-plus years. And it was never a full-time job, you know. I mean, I also had other things going, and I was able to, I was doing some soap opera work, two or three soap operas in New York. And so in between other stuff I was doing, but at the most maybe 130 days in costume a year. So, and travel, always travel. You know, my second home was LaGuardia Airport. They would just fly me constantly all over the place. And kind of my motto, I tried to make each child feel like a best friend they haven't seen in a while, because I knew that's how they felt about me. I tried to treat each kid like each kid was a best friend I hadn't seen in a long time. So I would, that was the way I greeted them. I was just like, oh, you know, they're thrilled to see me. I'm thrilled to see you. You know, I haven't, you know, making each kid feel like they're Spider-Man's best friend. In mid-'80s, I think 86, Marvel Comics teamed up with the National Committee for Prevention of Child Abuse to publish a very special Spider-Man comic book dealing with, believe it or not, child sexual abuse. This special edition Spidey comic book in which Peter Parker, Spider-Man's alter ego, the story was about Peter Parker being sexually abused by a friend that I thought was a friend, but turned out that he had ulterior motives. And it really, it doesn't, it's not graphic or anything, but it just, it tells the story of Peter Parker being sexually abused by
That's pretty intense for children.
Unreal, yeah. So in the comic book, for this to happen to Peter Parker, and it just tore him up, you know. It's a story about a kid who's being, who's been abused and didn't know how to deal with it. He finally gathered the strength and courage to tell his Aunt May and Uncle Ben. And they believed him, and they helped him deal with it. So this is a lesson in how to deal with it if it's happening to you, you know. They would have me go to schools around the elementary schools around the country and do an appearance and talk about what's in the book. So for 6 or 7 years, every April was Child Abuse Prevention Month. I traveled all over the country doing days at a city's elementary schools. And then finally,
did the kids ask you questions? That seems like a very fragile, delicate subject to be talking to children.
They had to have a social worker person to be there for just that, for answering questions. The interesting thing was, you know, in many places, kids were lining up at the guidance counselor's office. I'm most proud of that.
Really?
Yeah.
I was going to say, did you mind doing it? Because they basically put you in that position.
See, it felt like I was doing something important, and I believed in it. I was approached by a couple of children's psychiatric hospitals to come in. And going in and talking with kids who were living in psychiatric hospitals who had been, I'll never forget one story. This guy, this doctor, there was a kid that they had been working with, trying to get him to open up and tell the story of what had been happening with his stepfather. Anyway, I had a flight out, so I get back to the hotel, and the head doctor called. He was in tears. And he said, Jimmy, who has been, who has refused to talk about the sexual abuse that he lived through, he finally, today, his first day, we actually were got through to him. He told his story. Because of you coming in, and, you know, it was an incredible opportunity. It was just a hell of an experience to do that kind of work and to feel like we're making a difference in somebody's lives. So
when you say hero and you think about superheroes, like, you know, flying in and saving things, but this was a very different kind of hero.
Different
right?
kind of hero, yeah, and they're everywhere, you know, in this world here, you know.
How many countries do you think you went to as Spider-Man?
Oh God, dozens. Again, I was traveling constantly. It's been quite a life. And as far as the, you know, the 22 years in the Spider-Man costume, a lot of sacrifice. You know, I never had children because who can have children when you're, you know, traveling to Ecuador to be Spider-Man, you know?
Did you want to? Were you in a relationship where you could have children or wanted to?
I was usually in a relationship, and I was married for a few years too back then. But, you know, I loved the job so much. I felt totally privileged to wear the webs and to go around saving children from child abuse. And, you know, it was one adventure after the next. And it was like every week I was traveling for many years, you know, for 20 years. So there was a lot of sacrifice in that regard.
Why did you stop doing Spider-Man?
I like to joke that, you know, when kids started hollering out, you know, "Suck it in, Spider-Man," it was time to hang up the webs. My final appearance was just after 9/11.
Okay, so that's been a while.
I didn't even know how to use a typewriter, for God's sake. But Actors Equity, the Actors Union, they have what they call an Actors Work program. They train actors to use a computer. And once I, you know, learned how to use a computer, I started looking around for office work. And I got into, we were doing focus groups and for a company that was also a polling company. And I was the top interviewer.
Did you do that long?
Yeah, that went on for a couple of years. And then I moved into a polling company, and we'd go out on streets and talk to, you know, strangers on the street, you know, and topics and whatever, and get, you know, public opinion as to what was happening.
So this was like a real job, real like...
Yeah. This is a 9-to-5 thing.
Oh,
first
wow.
time ever. But I was making real money for the first time in my life, a paycheck that I could count on, and that was new.
Did you do that long?
No, because I moved on to market research, and then I was VP of corporate development for a couple of branding firms, corporate brand identity, creative, and consulting firms, where we would design logos and for large companies. But I had a dozen years driving a desk. I learned the world of business.
Did you like that?
You know, I didn't love it. You know, I really had a generous commission for companies that I would unlock, and ultimately they become clients. And all of a sudden, I'm making six figures. You know, you know, where 3 years before I was running around the country in a, you know, spandex costume, and that made my father really. It changed his way to look at me.
And you were doing this when, in your what age? 50s.
Yes.
I'm just wondering when you took on this new career in the business world, this new...
Early 2000s, when all of this was beginning to come together. I never got the rush, though, of, you know, if I scored a new client or, you know, through a lot of work, finally we got a gig, you know, for the company.
Did you keep acting along the way or not?
I was still doing some off-Broadway theater. Did some good stuff. It was nothing of great renown. But, you know, I had a day job. I had an office. I had a desk. And that was really my focus. I had to, stay concentrated on that. But I still loved acting. I took some acting classes. I never lost the passion for it, I guess you could say.
So you don't have a day job now?
You know, I'm collecting Social Security, for God's sake. I'm retired, but I still need income. So I'm doing some stuff here. I'm doing actually more and more over the past year. I've been doing what they call background or extra work in major film production, HBO streaming services and everything. And I'm getting some attention there, too.
Doing what? You mean acting?
Yeah, acting. Being you know, they costume you. They stick you in the background, kind of, you know. And then, but often more than that, frankly. I'm finding it, really, this is fun. This is, and this is news to me. After Rita died, a friend of mine had been doing quite a bit of it for years and said, "Jerry, you really got to, you know," because I went into a bad space for too long. He said, "Jay, you got to really do this. They're casting calls where they're looking for people to be a pedestrian walking by the action or whatever, you know, but these are major stuff going on here in town. A lot of production in New York now." I did 3 days on Maisel, the marvelous Ms. Maisel.
I've watched her.
Yeah. And
that's interesting. What kind of character were you?
I was a rich guy. One episode they had me at, it was set in the Friars Club, the roast where they roast celebrities. They had me as one of like 100 different background people in tuxedos and gowns and everything. This was an event and a huge production, you know, where you've got like 500 people working on the set. And I discovered that I really love to be on a set. It's just, you know, it's breathtaking. All these creative people, you know, working in sync to put together a show like this. And when I first got to New York, we didn't talk about this, but I was getting some soap opera work. I'm even now collecting a pension from the soap opera work I did back in the 80s. I was like one of the doctors whenever they had a hospital scene in Ryan's Hope, The Guiding Light. You know, I was there.
But you're acting now. You have acting jobs now.
Yeah, I got two films coming up. And this one company, they're my people now. It's called In the Garage Productions. They've got one that I'm really excited about.
What character are you?
My character is Grandpa, actually. And it's a family drama about a grandfather who's dying. But it's very funny. A retired baseball star. He's my age. The family moves in with him because he's dying of cancer. And so we've all kind of been through that, you know. And this script just landed on my lap, like so many things in my life tend to land on my lap. My best friend Margo says, Jerry, you always land on your feet somehow, you know. And if there's anything that defines who Jerry Kolpitz is that you can count on him landing on his feet, you know. I've had so many near catastrophic experiences, and somehow, you know, check in with me a year later, things are going good, you know, and I feel that way right now. And then another film from another company. So I've got two projects.
Do you feel like acting is pretty much your destiny? I mean, I just wonder because you've stayed with it so long.
If I keep my arms open to it, it seems to be happening. You know, I'm not really interested in making the rounds and doing, you know, audition after audition and, you know, doing that. But I know enough people now that when things come up, I'm available usually. So I do get phone calls.
Maybe the overall question is, what do you think you've embraced from acting, or what do you think about sort of staying on a path you feel is yours? Because I think it's hard for people to do that, or it's hard for people to say, you know, I want to do this or I want to do that. And they go, oh, it costs too much. Or I don't have time or I don't have money. About, you know, doing something you feel is yours to do.
And it's still something that I do have I hate the word passion for, you know, follow your passion, yeah, and you wind up, you know, it doesn't always work out. But in fact, I would tell people that it's a horrible career choice if you're looking for any kind of stability, you know, in your life, or you want to raise a family or everything. It's, you know, you're better off to, you know, have a real useful skill, education, whatever. We have all been through disastrous times in our lives, just grief, and I'm just coming out of that now after, you know, Rita died. You know, the only salvation is to try and live your life with love and kindness. Sobriety is a huge, enormous part of that, though. I've been 9 years sober now and still going to meetings. I was in rehab and living in Florida for a year while in recovery, basically. And boy, it's remarkable what that change did for me. You know? But yeah, no, I'm excited about the next project. Always excited about the next project. You know, and being on some of these movie sets now, and I'm getting 3-4 days a month. You know, I'm one of the background people, and they often have 100 background people. Just top directors in film are directing these shows now, you know, and I tend to always kind of, the director, he looks over who he's getting as background. We need somebody to, you know, to have a moment here, walk by and do a double take, or the star looks at me or something. That I always tend to get picked out. I'm tall. And
how tall are you?
I'm 6'2". And I'm 175 pounds, you know, so I'm in shape. And I'm 70, for God's sake. I still got hair.
That's a good thing, yeah.
I don't know. Christ, it's luck of the draw. But anyway, I just love being around that creative atmosphere.
Thanks, Jerry. That's great. Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks.
I've been talking with actor Jerry Kolpitz in Brooklyn, New York. I'm Rhonda Miller. Music for The Age of Being Real is Kites Over the Ocean by the Kentucky Standard Band from their album Angels of Mercy.